You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Paul Muldoon, the poetry editor of the magazine, and it's a pleasure to welcome you here. On this program, as many of you will recall, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the archive. We hear it, we discuss it, and then we ask him, in this case, to read one of his own poems, or in this case, translations. Poems, translations, we'll talk about that in a moment or two. That has been published in the magazine. And one of the reasons why I'm hesitant about thinking about whether or not they're original poems or translations or such notions, whether or not they might come into play, has to do with the fact that our guest is Stephen Mitchell, one of the great translators of the era, a poet himself, of course, but a translator of such works as the Odyssey, the Iliad, the Bhagavad Gita, among so many other texts. Welcome, Stephen Mitchell.
Thank you, Paul.
Now, the poem you have chosen to read is Two Voices in a Meadow by Richard Wilbur, one of the great American poets of the era. What would one say? He's been a colossus for so many of us for so long. When I was starting out in the poetry business 50 years ago, Richard Wilbur was one of my heroes. He continues to be one of my heroes, and I've no doubt that he's a hero of your own.
Yes, from age 20, I actually met him back then during an interview for the Amherst Literary Magazine, and I was quaking in my shoes. It was a wonderful experience of awe. And I still treasure his poems.
So you were a student at Amherst?
Yes.
And was he teaching there at the
time?
No,
he was teaching at Wesleyan. Mm-hmm. So I had to make a little trip to Middletown, Connecticut, quaking in my shoes all the time.
What are your strongest memories of Richard Wilbur at that time?
He was a handsome man, very intelligent, of course, and gracious to a young student, and I was deeply moved by that and deeply grateful that he gave me the time.
Now, one of the things that we admire about Richard Wilbur is his, the way we describe it, I suppose, is his extraordinary technical facility. It's a kind of curse, I think, for many writers. There is, in some intellections, a notion that facility actually suggests the facile. Mm. For some people, there's a sense that actually it's mere facility, that it's all surface, no content. Mm-hmm. None of this seems to apply to Richard Wilbur.
No, I mean, you're right. It can be that for lesser poets, what I appreciate about Richard Wilbur, among many other things, is the acute sensitivity of his ear, his inner ear. For me, that puts him in this sense among poets with an exquisite ear like Wallace Stevens and T.S. Eliot in an odd way. And going back among the great English poets to the poet I consider who has the greatest ear of all, John Milton, even more than Shakespeare in a certain way, the sensitivity to vowels and changes of meter within a metrical system that are just fill you with delight at these subtle little changes. And we'll see that in the poem that I'm going to be reading.
Well, indeed, just looking ahead, and we'll hear it in a moment because we do want our listeners to have a sense of what we're talking about. I notice even there's the relationship between the cherubs in line one of A Milkweed and the crib in line two. One is echoic of the other, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if you ever do this, but when I love a poem, I sometimes try to take it apart a little and see why what's good is so good, like substituting words and seeing why the poet actually chose the word. So, for example, in this one, the first line is anonymous as cherubs. And I was wondering, well, why didn't he use angels? Because it fits the meter, anonymous as angels, and it has that nice assonance too. But that would lose the reference to babies. Cherubs are baby angels, mm-hmm. and although in ancient Hebrew they're fearsome beasts. So the baby angels and the crib of God, the nativity scene, add something to the poem that simply angels wouldn't.
You know, let's hear the poem, Richard Wilbur, Two Voices in a Meadow, read here by Stephen Mitchell.
Two voices in a meadow, a milkweed, anonymous as cherubs over the crib of God. White seeds are floating out of my burst pod. What power had I before I learned to yield? Shatter me, great wind. I shall possess the field. A stone, as casual as cow dung under the crib of God, I lie where chance would have me, up to the ears in sod. Why should I move? To move befits a light desire. The sill of heaven would founder, did such as I aspire.
Now, one of the first things I notice about this poem is that it's a diptych. It's in two parts. It's actually quite painterly, to use that overly used term.
That had never occurred to me. Yes.
Well, I mean, it part of it, of course, has to do with the relationship in the second line of each verse, or each stanza, I should say, over the crib of God and then under the crib of God, and that's the connective tissue, as it were, between mm-hmm. the two parts mm-hmm. of the poem.
Yes, it's the up and the down of things. And their two voices are marvelous. One of the reasons that I love this poem so much is that it is about the experience of surrender. And I don't know of too many poems that address that. It's such a central and critical experience in any kind of spiritual practice. And this poem comes, or at least the first part of it, comes very close to what words can express about it, although the experience is, of course, inexpressible. But I love the personification that tries to express that inexpressible experience. The personification of the milkweed and the stone, both of them mentioning the crib of God, so you have a kind of little nativity scene here.
That's right.
You know, you have, in addition to the talking animals, the ox and the ass at the nativity scene, you have a talking milkweed and a talking stone to complete the picture. And there's such humor in that, as well as the seriousness of the issue of surrender.
You, of course, are, if this is an appropriate term, rather wonderfully versed in the central notions of the Buddhist tradition. And in that sense, I think this poem really is of a piece with that, isn't it, in terms
Certainly
of surrender?
And, you know, it's also of a piece with the essence of the Taoist tradition, which is the Tao Te Ching, one of the books I've published. I did a really free, not so much a translation, but an adaptation of it. And at the center of the Tao Te Ching, which makes it so meaningful to millions of Americans, and Europeans, is the emphasis on yielding. And that's counterintuitive to what we have in our culture, which is a culture of control and power. So in the Tao Te Ching, we hear lines like, yielding is the way of the Tao. In other words, once you can learn to let yourself be carried by the current of life rather than making such stressful efforts to control life, once you can find the way to let yourself be carried away, everything becomes effortless, and that's the end of practice. There's no more practice at that point. There's simply a joyful, effortless living. And the first part of the poem is about yielding, and it expresses it with a kind of passion that I find rare in poetry.
My own view is that the greatest poets understand that some version of giving oneself over to something beyond oneself, be it the language,
mm-hmm.
be it yeah. quote-unquote merely the language, is actually an absolute prerequisite to doing anything of interest.
Yes, yes, I agree. And you can tell when a poem is controlled that it becomes intellectual and, you know, what you first mentioned about technique, it becomes about technique rather than a giving oneself up to something, giving up the ego to what Wilbur here calls the great wind, what, of course, the milkweed would experience mm-hmm. as the wind. And in many languages, as you know, wind and spirit are the same word.
Inspiration.
Yes.
Inspiration.
So in Greek and Hebrew and... although not in English, in English we have two words. But backing up a little, what I love about this poem is that the pattern, the meter is, I experience it as iambic trimeter, but there's hardly an iambic line in it or fully iambic. So, you know, when you begin, anonymous as cherubs, you only have two beats in that line, over the crib of God, you begin not with an iamb. White seeds are floating, and you have those two emphases at the beginning, white, which is delicious to my ear. And then out of my burst pod, again, two emphases at the end of the line. And then when you get to this wonderful climax, shatter me, great wind. I mean, there's such a wonderfully satisfying breath that you have to make at that point. Shatter me, great wind. Again, two beats at the end of the line. It just expresses what the meaning is in such an integrated way that there's a breath of excitement, of exhilaration about that experience of destruction.
You know, one of the words I find fascinating here is the very first word in the poem. It's the word anonymous. And anonymity, of course, is something that we associate with that, the complete setting to one side of the self that mm-hmm. we were discussing. Mm-hmm. It's a term that's associated, of course, with some of the great poems in most languages. They are written by anonymous people, as it were.
Including the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Well, that's right. And in many ways, it's a term that far too often, perhaps, came to be associated with the translator himself or herself. That actually, you know, that one didn't know and one didn't care for too long as to who translated a piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in a way, that's a good thing. What you should care about is it well done, not who did it. Just as it's really satisfying in a certain way to have anonymous as a poet, because the poem is what's important. And also, you know, I hadn't noticed this before, but now that you point it out, the anonymous is really the end point of what happens when you're able and willing to say, shatter me. You end up as what Emily Dickinson called nobody. I'm nobody. Who are you? How wonderful to be nobody. And it's an achievement, actually. Not everybody can be nobody, because it takes a great kind of maturity to get to that point.
Well, it does, and it's absolutely essential. Having said that, it is inevitable that the DNA of the translator, and in this, let's talk about Wilbur as a translator, for example.
Oh, he's a wonderful translator.
Wilbur.
His Molière is just so exquisitely done and witty and intelligent and amazingly keeps the rhyme and the meter of Molière,
okay, so
more
it,
or less.
But it is his Molière,
yes.
And that's my point. I mean,
yes.
So that tension that we're describing here between anonymity and his Molière is actually a rather interesting
one. Yeah, it's very interesting. There's a paradox in the art of translation, and I do want to get back to the second part of the Wilbur poem, but a really good translator, at least in my experience, needs to be transparent. That means to step aside from his ego or her ego enough to let the poet flow through him, and yet at the same time, when that is achieved, it turns out that the personality of the translator is as fully infused throughout the translation as the egolessness, so that you can read a translation by somebody who's really good and say, ah, that's got to be done by so-and-so, in the same way that you hear a piece of Goldberg Variations, and you know that's Glenn Gould or that's Murray Pariah. You can't help but write through your personality, although it's not necessarily so that you write with your personality.
You know, one of the ways I find rather useful, it's maybe a bit fanciful, a way of thinking about how translation functions, and I wonder if it would mean anything to you. I mean, it sounds like some sort of Platonic view of the world, but it's as if there is an ur/ideal text. Both the first writer and the translator are appealing to a notion of what that might be. Does that mean anything to you at all?
That's interesting. What I would make of it is that the poet of the original poem, whether or not anonymous, is listening to something.
Mm-hmm.
And the listening eventually becomes the words. So, you know, it's not something, if a poem is really good, it's not something, in a sense, he's creating. It is creating through him,
right,
or her, and that's what becomes the poem. So in the same way, a really good translator is listening, but it's stereophonic. So in one ear, he has the original poem in the original language, and in the other ear, there's pure, you could say pure longing or pure silence where nothing is happening and he cannot force it and will not force it. And then at a certain point, the English words form by themselves as that counterpoint to the original language. And then it's done. Once it's on a page, you know, there may be 10 or 20 versions as he fine-tunes it, but the original, that first version cannot be forced.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I would love to move on, if I may, to one of your own translations. It was a piece that appeared in the September 23, 2013 issue of The New Yorker, and it's an excerpt from your great translation of the Odyssey, and it ran under the title The Death of Argos. Maybe you give us a little bit of the background to that.
Oh, sure. It's this little excerpt is like a hologram of the whole Odyssey. Everybody knows the story of Odysseus who fought in the Trojan War, and then was held up for 10 years after those 10 years of war in various places with various adventures with various monsters. And after all that, 20 years later, he finally makes his way with the permission of the gods back to Ithaca. And this particular incident happens when he's just walking back to his palace with the help of the faithful swineherd, Eumaeus. And we'll see what happens in the excerpt.
Why don't we just go straight to it? The death of Argos from the Odyssey, book 17, lines 260 to 327, translated and read here by Stephen Mitchell.
Meanwhile, Odysseus arrived along with the swineherd. They stopped in front of the palace, and all around them echoed the sound of the lyre. It was Phemius striking the chords of the prelude as he began his song. Odysseus took hold of the swineherd's hand, and he said, "This house right here must be Odysseus's palace. How splendid it is, and how easy to pick it out at a glance from 100 others. One building leads into the next, and the courtyard is very well built with its corniced wall, and the double doors are so solid that no enemy could break through. A crowd must be feasting inside now. I can smell the roast meat, and I hear the lyre which the gods have made the crown of a banquet." Then, in response to his words, Eumaeus, you said, "It is easy for someone as clever as you to notice that kind of thing. But now we need to consider what we should do. Either you enter the palace first and approach the suitors, and I will stay here, or you stay here if you wish, and I will go first. But don't be too long. Someone may see you waiting and throw a stone or a spear at you. You must be careful." Odysseus said to him, "All right, I understand. You go in first, and I will remain behind. I am accustomed to being beaten and having things thrown at me. My heart has endured. Before now, I have suffered great hardships, both on the sea and in war. And if I must suffer another hardship, so be it. But a man can't hide the belly's accursed craving, which causes so many evils and makes us sail ships across the vast sea to bring war upon distant people." As they spoke, a dog who was lying there lifted his head and pricked up his ears. It was Argos, Odysseus's dog. He had trained him and brought him up as a puppy, but never hunted with him before he sailed off to Troy. In earlier times, the young men had taken him out with them to hunt for wild goats and deer and hares. But he had grown old in his master's absence, and now he lay abandoned on one of the heaps of mule and cattle dung that piled up outside the front gates until the farmhands could come by and cart it off to manure the fields. And so the dog Argos lay there, covered with ticks. As soon as he was aware of Odysseus, he wagged his tail and flattened his ears, but he lacked the strength to get up and go to his master. Odysseus wiped a tear away, turning aside to keep the swineherd from seeing it, and he said, "Eumaeus, it is surprising that such a dog of such quality should be lying here on a dunghill. He is a beauty, but I can't tell if his looks were matched by his speed, or if he was one of those pampered table dogs which are kept around just for show." Then, in response to his words, Eumaeus, you said, "This is the dog of a man who died far away. If he were now what he used to be when Odysseus left and sailed off to Troy, you would be astonished at his power and speed. No animal could escape him in the deep forest once he began to track it. What an amazing nose he had. But misfortune has fallen upon him now that his master is dead in some far distant land, and the women are all too thoughtless to take any care of him. Servants are always like that. When their masters aren't right there to give them their orders, they slack off, get lazy, and no longer do an honest day's work, for Zeus Almighty takes half the good out of a man on the day he becomes a slave." With these words, he entered the palace and went to the hall where the suitors were assembled at one of their banquets. And just then, death came and darkened the eyes of Argos, who had seen Odysseus again after 20 years.
It's got it all, hasn't it? I mean, the poignancy, the dramatic irony, the... For want of a better term, though I'm sure I could think of one, you know, the cinematic variation of the shot in which Homer excels, with the great wide shot and then the close-up and the medium or mid-shot.
Yeah, it's a moment of great excitement, and it's the climax of the whole story, really, or at least the climax is getting very close, where Odysseus enters the palace and there's a huge battle between him and a couple of helpers and all the suitors. But to have, at this moment of intense tension and excitement, to have the poignance of this wonderful, loyal dog there is just, who would have thought it, but a great poet.
Now, remind me, Penelope doesn't quite recognize Odysseus.
No, not at first at all. Nobody does this. I mean, Eumaeus, the swineherd, doesn't. That's why Odysseus doesn't want to go up to Argos, the dog. He wipes away a tear.
That's
in secret.
A fabulous moment, too, isn't it? The wiping away the tear. Just to ask you a question, forgive me for bringing this up, because it's just not the sort of thing that's done in polite society.
I forgive you.
Polite society. But don't you think it's a bit strange that Penelope doesn't recognize Odysseus?
Well, you know, Penelope is a puppet in the hands of the great master poet. So if he doesn't want her, for dramatic tension, not to recognize him, she's not going to recognize him. But, you know, you could say it's easy. You add 20 years to a man, you disguise him as a beggar. You give him grubby clothes and a grubby beard. And in addition, you add in your plot a few physical changes by the gods, and you've got a recipe for non-recognition.
Yeah, I think it is psychologically, physically verifiable. One shouldn't quibble with such things.
Well, but of course, I mean, it's a given in the poem, and how delicious that makes the moment of recognition again, and how even super delicious it makes the moment when, at the end of the poem, they go to bed together and have a most passionate night.
Well, that detail of the recognition of the bedpost, of course, is another extraordinary moment.
Yeah. A modern critic, Daniel Mendelssohn, has said that the poem is probably the greatest tribute in literature to married love. And I think that's an extraordinary insight. I've certainly felt that myself. And certainly at that length, there aren't that many mature tributes to married love in poetry. And this is one of the great ones. Whatever you think of the morality of that slaughter at the end, for some people, it's very satisfying. For others, might be a bit squeamish about it. But in any case, the slaughter has possibly increased Odysseus's libido when he gets to bed. So they have a most wonderful night of it.
Well, you know what? I think that's the perfect place on which to draw a veil over our over our conversations, which I've enjoyed so much. Stephen Mitchell, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
So Death of Argus, Stephen Mitchell's translation of that section of Homer, as well as Richard Wilbur's poem, Two Voices in a Meadow, may both be found on newyorker.com. Richard Wilbur's latest book of poems is Collected Poems, 1943 to 2004. So thrilled to think that Richard Wilbur is still with us and going strong. And Stephen Mitchell's most recent collection is Parables and Portraits. Thank you very much indeed.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Pintigree Ferryman from the album The Highlander's Farewell by Alastair Fraser and Natalie Haas from Colburnie Records. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.